hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm your host, Cindy House. Hey, thanks for listening today. It's real good to have you. So this conversation, I think, was really good with Amy Helm. I think Amy and I were both surprised by the quality of the conversations. She seemed to really like my questions, and I for sure really loved her answers. Amy Helm grew up surrounded by some of the most influential musicians in American roots music, including her father, Levon Helm, legendary drummer and singer for the band. That also meant that her childhood was a, quote, very colorful experience where she was raised by, quote, a village of brilliant and talented people who were also wrestling with the grips of addiction. When she was a kid, she liked kid things, just like a normal kid. Case in point, she attended the fabled 1976 concert The Last Waltz, where she was 5 years old. Her most prominent memory of the concert, all the candy and snacks her and the other kids were given backstage. She also didn't have a great relationship with her dad until she was a young adult. Levon took her on the road to tour with his blues band, The Barn Burners. He thought she was ready, and it was trial by fire each night on the road for young Amy. She learned so much from that experience. After that, she and her dad started his much-loved Rambles at the Barn in his Woodstock home. Those nights started as a rent party for Levon, who had just overcome addiction, survived throat cancer, and had just filed for bankruptcy. They soon grew into a Woodstock institution, featuring artists such as Emmylou Harris, Alan Toussaint, Elvis Costello, Phil Lesh, and many more. After Levon died, Amy decided to record and release her first solo album at age 44. Now she's on her third record, the excellent and very personal What the Flood Leaves Behind. She also, thankfully, has been able to break the cycle of addiction in her own life, raising 2 young sons as a single mom. Amy's brought the best of her childhood into their lives with lots of music. On the album, she reflects on the people who raised her and how they did their best. She ruminates on creativity out of loss in the song Verse 23, written by MC Taylor, aka His Golden Messenger, particularly with the line, "What the flood leaves behind is what we've got to make." Amy wanted to record the album in the Mexican desert, which I fully support. However, after crunching numbers, it made more sense to use the barn, the space her dad had designed and built specifically for musicians. That ended up being so clutch in the making of this music. Being in the space where she learned to sing and watch some of her dad's most joyful performances allowed her and producer Josh Kaufman to fully relax and lean into these songs. Hope you enjoy our conversation with Amy Helm. We'll take a listen to a song from her new album. We'll hear Cotton and the Cane, and then we'll get to our conversation with Amy Helm on Basic Folk.
Lucky charms, false alarms, and up all night, voices in the other room. Mama's prayers and honeysuckle, white lightning, hurricanes, cracked hands, thank you ma'ams, driving rain, murder in the drain. Breakdowns and the poetry of the poor. My father was a sharecropper's son, handed hope and hymns to ease the pain.
Amy Helm, thank you so much for talking to me today. This is so rad to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be asked and to be part of it.
I have been spending the past couple of days doing a deep dive on your life and I hope, like, I was writing questions up until the last minute, so I hope that this is a good experience for everyone, because you have, like, there's just so much to talk about. The new album is beautiful. So let's just dive right in.
Great. Let's do it.
Okay, first I want to talk about women. You're a musician who has been surrounded by, mentored by, performed with a lot of, like, incredibly influential men your entire life, like your dad being a huge part of your experience. But I wanted to start talking about the women. Like, where did the women show up in your musician experience?
Yeah, what an interesting question. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when I was 13, maybe 12, I heard Aretha Franklin for the first time. And that set me on fire in a way that, like, all of these people I'd had around me that were mostly male teachers, all of a sudden this voice shot through me. You know, it was like being hit by lightning,
yeah.
I'm sure for millions of people. And it then led me into discovering and exploring tons of other female vocals and female singers. But my teachers continued to be mostly men, honestly. So I was getting, like, I was getting the mentorship through the speakers and through the headphones, and then getting the in-person experience there. But as I got older and started singing in bands, by the time I was in my late 20s, I started working with Olabelle, and that had another woman in the band, Fiona McBain, who's a beautiful singer. And yeah, to be honest with you, as I'm retracing my steps as we're talking. I'm sorry, I'm kind of coming out of school pickup and kids and the dog and getting my coffee and getting my head into interview mode. So forgive me for wandering. As I'm retracing my steps, I can say that I didn't have as many female teachers. And I think that part of that was probably just that there weren't as many women doing it at that time, I think, as there are now, to be completely honest, or at least the ones I was around. So it was in my record player. It was with my friends, with other girls that were trying to sing or learn instruments. It was in church with some of the singers there. It was from my grandmother's hymnal and the songs that she liked, and it was all of that passed down. And it's just a very interesting thing to be 50 years old now and think back about that time coming up, which wasn't so long ago, right? It's not someone in their 80s reflecting back. It's not that long ago that it wasn't as common to find and connect with a lot of women. And so I think by the time I was in my 30s and 40s, I was able to connect and cross paths with so many singers and so many women. And then that became my peers became my teachers, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, my peers became my teachers, starting with Fiona. I'm just going back in my mind to all the girls back then during the Olabelle days that we crossed paths with: Aoife O'Donovan, Ruthie Unger from the Mammals, all the girls that were
the greatest.
Yeah, all the girls that were singing back there back then. And we kind of would, you know, dig each other's stuff and connect and call when we needed a talk down or turn each other on to different music that we had been listening to. And so now, of course, you know, my female friendships and my female mentors, like Mavis is a huge mentor to me. And she was someone who was present in my life from a young age up. But, you know, those people, that's your foundation. Those are your rocks.
Yeah. I saw the reason that it was making me think of that question was that you posted this really great video of you and some young women who maybe I couldn't tell if they were like teenagers on your social media playing together, and was like, poof.
Yeah. Yes. That's Kaya Dedeck, Story Littleton, and Michaela Davis. And they're all very, well, I guess Story just turned 20. Kaya is 18, and I'm not sure, Michaela might be in her early 20s, but not much out of her teens. So that was a really powerful thing. And actually Story's mom, Elizabeth Mitchell, who's a fierce artist and musician. You know Elizabeth Mitchell's music, and she does a bunch of kids' music, and she's also produced a lot of records. And she filmed that video, and she had the idea, you know, we did that downstairs This actually ties beautifully into your question and the original idea of female mentors and us kind of taking on the baton passed down, having the flame passed down to the next generation of girls. And Liz wanted to film that. Downstairs at the barn, we have this incredible kind of mini museum of awards and cool pictures and cool things of different musicians and stuff my dad has done. And so she purposely had that. And we're kind of surrounded by my dad and Rick Danko and Byron Isaacs from Olabel and Tony and all these Hubert Sumlin and Muddy Waters and all these different incredible players, and with all those beautiful young girls in that circle with them. So it was a really nice idea on Liz's part.
Yeah. I love that idea. And I also love that you now get to be there for them, and they just thought it was really lovely.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of my favorite things. I love being at the age that I'm at and being able to do that. It's my favorite thing, really.
I want to hear about the impact of singing hymns, singing and learning hymns as a child. Hymns were the first songs that you would sing at home with your dad and your grandparents. So how do those hymns remain in your singing today?
I warm up with them all the time. I love to warm up with hymns. Yeah, I love the simplicity of the melodies, and I love the simplicity of the melody, and also because of the simplicity of the melody, I can find it my kind of amateur-ish mandolin playing. So a lot of times if I'm sound checking, I like to use that with my mandolin to kind of get inside of the room and find out where my voice lays in it. And I also use them for writing sometimes too, just singing a hymn and being pulled back to the simplicity of a line melodically and also lyrically, and trying to kind of reflect some of that in my own writing too.
Mm. Do you have some greatest hits for hymns that you like to pull out?
Yeah, definitely. I love the song Abide With Me, which it's come to mind because I recently started singing it at a gig at Soundcheck, and Adam Levy, who's a phenomenal guitar player who I have had the opportunity to do some shows with this summer, he knew there's a version of it that I think Duke Ellington did that has these kind of incredible, obviously incredible, complex and reharmonized chords, but I know the simple 1-4-5 version of it, and I love that song. I love the lyrics to that song and the melody. It's something to check out if anyone's listening and is into hymns. It's a nice one to learn. And I also love one that's called Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is a song Martha Scanlon taught me. Martha Scanlon's an incredible singer and songwriter, and she's one of my dearest friends. And I never heard that hymn till she was singing it. And I love the lyrics of that song. Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy praise. You know, it's like one of these hymns that you can pull right out of any kind of religious liturgy or any of that. Yeah. And just put it right into, you know, something right in nature. It's a really nice place to sit with it.
You describe your childhood as very colorful. That's a word. Colorful comes up a lot. You lived with your mom, who was married to Dr. John for a little while.
Together for 7 years, yeah.
And is now married to Donald Fagen. Your dad was playing music with all sorts of different people in the band and with other bands. And you live between Woodstock, L.A., New York City. You are a parent. You have two boys who are 9 and 13.
Yeah.
So what has your childhood taught you about parenting and being a musician at the same time?
Thankfully, it taught me a lot. It taught me that I really wanted to break the cycle of addiction in my legacy, in my history, in my family history. And I wanted to create a household and a place that was safe and really consistent and something that fostered trust. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity and that I continue to have the opportunity to do that, which is because of a lot of great teachers and a lot of great people, and because all the people that were so crazy that I grew up with, watching them change their lives. You know, I got to watch a lot of people, unfortunately, fall victim to so much darkness and addiction, but I've seen people, I've lost people to it, but I've also seen people survive it and change. And that was a lot. And also, dark humor gets you through a lot of stuff. I learned at a young age that, you know, a handful of dark jokes, you know, that can make things a lot easier. And I found people, you know, we all have stories, and a lot of my friends have come through stuff. We all have stuff we've come through. And so finding some laughter about it and learning how to create a place for yourself in your life that's your own solid ground, and then trying to be a light to others and get better at that. So I try every day to do that with my kids.
Yeah.
And I fail every day, but at least I'm walking in the right direction. I'll just end to say, because in case any moms or dads or parents are listening, there's a beautiful catchphrase that a wonderful family counselor and therapist taught me that comes from attachment parenting, which is bigger, like whenever you're reacting to your kids, bigger, kinder, wiser, stronger. And I always keep that in my head, like to take a breath and be that to ourselves and to our children, like to let that part of your divinity be present in your household. And that's what I try to do.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, this next question is about the other rock and roll kids that you grew up with, or maybe other rock and roll kids who are adults now. So your understanding of what your dad's job was as a little kid is really funny. You were like, oh, he plays drums in Rick Danko's band, and Stage Fright
is the hit.
Is their big hit. So, yeah. So precious. At 5 years old, you were at the last waltz, which definitely is a fact that I texted my best friend today. Yes. That I learned about. I was like, Amy Helm was at the last waltz. She was five. But you were with the other kids, and you said, I recall the backstage area where all the kids were put into this wild room with toys and snacks and babysitters. So, like, how did you relate to those other kids of musicians? Do you have friendships with adults now who are kids of musicians? And is there like a special relationship there?
Yeah, I do have friends that are kids of musicians. And I think, you know, related to them at the time, you know, especially like in the high school years, I don't know if it's specific to having parents that have some kind of fame or public recognition, but, you know, you get self-conscious about how you're seen as your parent's kid. And I'm starting to see that, yeah, there's some of that that has to do with like your dad or your mom's on stage. But I think everybody feels that way. Like, you know, I live in a small town and I see that now with teenagers. I'm like, oh, everybody's like, you know, my friend's kid, and my friend owns the hardware store, and they're embarrassed when someone's like knows the guy from the hardware store. There's that aspect to it. Right. But I think there was a camaraderie.
It's like an expectation.
Yes, or like having to take, you know, we all take the projections onto us. And I do think this is more exaggerated in a small town. But, you know, everybody knows each other in a small town, and people project onto you what they know of you from your family, whether you're in rock and roll or carpentry. You know, it's kind of like, I think that's just part of human nature. But anyway, I say all of that to say, I think there was a camaraderie with some of the kids that were growing up who had the same self-consciousness about their parents doing the same thing, and managing the same projections onto you a little bit. And I'm still friends with Graham Lesh is a really dear friend of mine, and we're in a band together, and I play a lot of music with him, and he's a wonderful guy. And, you know, sometimes it's funny to talk in shorthand about something, but those are cool friendships. It's nice to have that simpatico about, you know, understanding, you know, if you're gonna choose music as a career and your parents play music, it's gonna be, you're gonna talk about it your whole career, and there's incredible rewards to that. And sometimes it can be, you know, you have to align yourself with it and not let it be something that makes you feel self-conscious, I think.
Okay, you're 16 years old and you get a tape of Big Pink, I think from your mom, and you really fell for the music as a fan, which is rad. Like at that, up until then, you were like, my dad plays in Rick Danko's band. But then you're listening to Big Pink, you love it, you're 16. That act of discovering that music by listening in the way you did at that age, it just sounds like, regardless or not if it's your dad on the album or not, it just sounds like such an important, poignant moment for you. So can you talk about being that age and taking that music in on your bus rides? Like, where was your headspace at that time, and like what music meant to you as a 16-year-old?
Yeah, that's funny. I was just telling my 13-year-old son, who's a deep music, he's a drummer and deep into music. And like, I was just telling him the same story. And it was so curious to him that I discovered the band without attaching it to it being my dad. I was trying to describe that experience to him, this kind of impersonal taking in of the music. But anyway, yeah, I just remember I was on the bus. I had this long bus ride because I hated the subway. So I'd take this like 45-minute bus ride up to 91st Street and Broadway to where I went to high school, all the way from 21st Street. And at the time, I was listening to tons of Aretha Franklin, Jimi Hendrix, and modern stuff, the Go-Go's, Tom Petty, everything that was being played on the radio in 1980, whatever it was, 85. But it was Richard Manuel's voice, especially singing Lonesome Susie, that was like, I just couldn't even comprehend. It was like someone seeing the ocean for the first time, you know, or seeing the Grand Canyon. I just remember feeling it wasn't moving. It was like I was seeing a new landscape, a new territory. I couldn't believe it existed. And I still feel that way every time I hear him sing. Every time I hear him sing, I'm like, God, if I could sing one little line of music and get it halfway as real and as unique as that, then maybe I've done something good. You know, he's just such an extraordinary, rare bird of a voice. And so that was the memory of it. And it is a funny thing. And I was, like I said, I was telling Lee this story, and he said, well, what do you mean you didn't think of it being your dad? And he said, well, were you seeing Papa a lot then? And I was like, actually, no, I hadn't seen him. You know, that was at a time when my dad was really not present in my life at all, because he was very much kind of falling prey to addiction and isolating and disappearing at that time. So, and Lee said to me, my son said, well, maybe you didn't want to know it was your dad. And I was like, interesting. Okay.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was pretty deep, but I thought about it and I thought, yeah, you know, you're right. It was this funny experience where, like, maybe because that was too painful, but then the musical part of me and the part of me that was a singer was like able to get flooded with it in some different way. I don't know. It was strange.
Okay, now we get to the Mary Gaucher fan club part of the interview.
She's the best of all time.
I just started reading her book. Have you picked it up yet?
I ordered 3 copies and I'm intending on beginning it next week. Yeah.
I saw her at a festival recently and she was selling her book, and I was thinking, like, I need to buy this person a copy, this person a copy, this person a copy. Like, I hadn't even read the book, and I
I ordered a bunch of copies as gifts for sure. Yeah.
I imagine I'm gonna try to read it as slow as possible because it's so. I'm in 2 chapters in. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Anywho, there is a song on the record that you and Mary wrote called "Cotton and the Cane," which you said is a homage to the village of brilliant and talented people who are also wrestling with the grips of addiction. And I read that the song has been written for like 4 years. But writing with Mary was like, I think the first time you talked about that experience outside of like close friends. What was that like about the vulnerability and courage it took for you to address the addiction and that the addiction that people in your life had experienced?
It was very vulnerable, and I had never really spoken about it because, you know, I've been singing for a really long time in a lot of different bands, but I came to my solo career later in life. I put out my first record when I was 44. And so, you know, when I was in Olabel and in my dad's band and different projects, I wouldn't have to do interviews that were so personal. It would always be focusing back on the collaboration. So I wasn't used to talking about it and doing that with ease and with self-trust, you know? And that song was definitely a bridge for me with that. And also, I think being a mom, you know, my kids getting a little bit older and starting to talk to them about what that is in our family's history and how I grew up. And they ask, you know, your kids ask you questions and you kind of tell your story to them. And then you're able to stand in your story. At least for me, I've experienced that. I stood in myself a lot differently after having to teach my kids about how I came up. And that song sort of perfectly collided in a sense or crossed paths with that time in my life as a mom when I was starting to tell the kids my story. And it was liberating. And now when I sing that song live, it's amazing to remember how many millions of people are affected by alcoholism and drug addiction. I mean, it's everywhere. So when I sing that song and I talk a little bit about coming through it, and, you know, I'll have at least 10 people every night come up and say something to me or share their experience with addiction with me about that. So it's been a nice reminder of just the humanity we all hold and open conversations and kind of the relief of that, you know, the freedom of being able to say what we've gone through and not hold it with any shame or embarrassment.
And you really picked the perfect person to co-write that song with.
Yes.
Mary Gaucher.
Yes, I did. I did. Yeah, I know. That happened, you know. Yeah, that happened. She and I are very in sync with a lot of that stuff. We've had similar experiences, I think, with some of that.
In chapter 2 of her book, halfway through the chapter, I'm like, how is she alive?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
So you sang with your dad on the road with his blues band, the Barn Burners, and this was a time where you were like not ready to perform, but he thought you were.
Yeah.
And you were learning how to perform kind of like trial by fire. What did that time teach you about like confidence in yourself, the ability to be courageous and push yourself outside your comfort zone?
Oh, man. Everything. That was the deep blue sea, man. That was the deep dive. That was the beginning. And then I think again, you know, I got a second round of that from my father singing in the Ramble Band, because that was a different extension of having to kind of step up and stand up, stand there and make the song happen. Well, you know, every night that I went out on stage, I was seen as nothing more and nothing less than Levon's daughter with like a little spotlight around me. And I was very young and I was very green and I was tremblingly insecure. And I was a natural singer and had found my voice in one part of myself and with my teachers in jazz and in school and with my peers, but I was never a very ambitious, kind of driven musician. I more was just kind of playing with people and playing in pockets and finding the next band and trying to get better, right? So when I would walk out onto these stages with that projection onto me and could feel the expectation and could feel the incredible admiration people had for my dad And then here I came, not good hard, you know,
barely
getting through a blues song and like dying inside, right? And it was baptism by fire, man. It was baptism by fire. And I really was not very good then. I had the natural talent, but I didn't have the knowing of how to hold myself in it. And, you know, frankly, to be completely honest, I mean, this has all come into me as because I haven't had questions asked like this in a long time, if ever. And honestly, the first question you asked me about female teachers, like, I wonder if I would have felt differently. I'm not taking anything away from my dad. He was great. But part of that was not having, you know, because now at 50, I see these young girls, like the girls that I've got to teach myself, Kaya and these girls, and mm-hmm. I see what they do at Rock Academy and I see what they do in the music schools. And if I had had a group of strong women teaching me and showing me how to go out on stage and teaching me how to do that stuff, maybe it would have felt differently. And I had some of that.
Yeah, Levon wasn't playing. He wasn't playing like the Lilith Fair or Michigan Women's Festival.
And he was also very old school. You know, he was which was cool. Like for him, he didn't really give a shit about what people thought in the truest of ways. Right. If I was like, Dad, I feel embarrassed or insecure because these people think I'm your daughter and all they wanted that. And he was like, he was just a different generation. He was like, honey, don't worry about that shit. Just get out there and play, you know, serve the song, put that bullshit out of your mind and serve the tune. And that's where he was at, which was very strong. But I had to figure out how to do that on my own because he couldn't feel what I was feeling up there, you know? So anyway, this is a long story, but I'll end it with this to say, we did a 3-week tour. We did 15 shows in 18 days. I remember this. I was maybe 27, but I felt like I was about 14. And I just kept hating it. And then finally we played this gig and all the coolest musicians in Memphis were in the audience. I mean, the baddest asses of them all, right? Steve Cropper, all these fucking guys. And I got out on stage and I don't know what happened. This is the only time this ever happened to me. And I started to sing the song in harmony and I was singing the right harmony, but I was a quarter step out of the key and I couldn't get back in. And I felt myself just dying in real time on stage, like a ship sinking in slow motion. I couldn't get back in key. And there they all were, all the musicians that had made all those records, the Stax family, everybody in Memphis and my dad. And I got back to the hotel in Memphis and I kind of had this moment with myself that was like, are you going to do this or not? Because if you want to do this, you have to push forward right now and never look back. Otherwise, walk away from it and forgive yourself and move. Just move in a direction. So I made that choice and I finished that tour. And by the end of that tour, I had gotten something that no one else could give me. You know, I could feel it when I took the stage.
Wow.
That was my beginning. Yeah.
Quick question about Olabel. Well, it's not a quick. Take as long as you want. So it's my understanding you went to New Orleans for a year and you were able to do a deep dive into gospel music. And then you moved to New York City. And it was right after September 11th you started taking part in the Songs for Singers gospel swap. And out of that came Olabel.
Songs for Sinners. Yeah, Songs for Sinners.
Songs for Sinners.
Yeah.
That's me.
No, that's fine. That's what the bartender at this bar named. He wanted to start a Sunday night, and he had a little fabric that he hung over the jukebox so no one could play the songs for sinners. And it was like a gospel night, but we didn't want any of the religion in it. We wanted everybody wanted the healing of it. It was right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And out of that came Olabel, and the band recorded 3 records and a live record. Performed gospel songs from the Al Nomex collection. So a lot of religious music. What did Olabel's non-secular catalog show you about people having the ability to connect to spiritual music, even if they are not religious?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was an incredible thing, because this was the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and people just wanted to hear something that reminded them of faith, whatever that faith looked like. We could be singing about Jesus, and someone could be in there, the biggest atheist on the block, and it didn't matter. People just needed to hear that somewhere, somehow, people were believing in something bigger than themselves. And that was a very powerful time. I'll never forget that, singing in that bar at that time, kind of putting it together in retrospect and thinking about that. And it was unusual.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Rambles started in 2004, and you had gone on the road with your dad, and it was just like right before that, your relationship with your dad started to heal. You guys became really, really close. And he had been just recovered from addiction, just recovered from throat cancer, and also had filed for bankruptcy. So the Rambles kind of started as like a rent party situation.
Yes. Yeah.
Just pretty cool. And then they turned into these like institutions featuring all these names in rock and roll. And I heard you tell this story. I can't remember whose podcast it was. It was another musician who plays with Susan and Derek Tedeschi.
Eric
band.
Krasno, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. I was listening to you on his podcast, and I think it was there where you told this incredible story of Levon getting back into singing after his treatment, and his voice was like really weak, and he being kind of afraid to sing, and you would like whisper sing the songs with him?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he'd have me sing unison with him, but I would do it really quiet on the mic. So it was sort of there like a safety net, so that if his voice fell out, you know, I would be there and I'd hold the melody for a couple lines and then till he got his voice back. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's always like a time in someone's life, if they're lucky enough to have their parents for long enough, where like the roles kind of start reversing.
Yeah.
You know, like talk about like truly supporting a parent.
I mean, it was so profound. And also, you know, I had gone through my own changes and growth and my own, what's the word I'm looking for? Not, I guess my own evolution, at least my first stage of evolution with the stories we were just talking about back when I was in my 20s with him, trying to find my own voice as a singer, and then to be able to use, you know, to then have it flip and kind of hand him what I had found and us, you know, it was a very special time. And he really gave me, in that time, he gave me just so much. I mean, it's hard to really articulate, but yes, to take care of our parents and to watch them and help them is a beautiful thing. And to be able to do it musically was profound.
Mm. My heart just exploded.
No.
A little bit.
Yeah, it was heavy. It was heavy for sure. It was heavy. I don't think I would be singing if it weren't for my dad. And that means a lot to me because I just love singing so much. Like I said to someone, even if I was given the choice to come back for 100 lifetimes as a broke singer, even singing in the tiniest dive bars forever for $5, I think I would do it. There's just nothing more satisfying than it. So he gave me what my joy was, you know.
I also really like it when you talk about how Levon Helm was not into like the music industry side of being a musician, like not into the pecking order, not into being a cool guy. He was a working musician's musician, not into the scene, but he was really into making people feel like they belong, make people feel connected to each other. And from that, like, where do you fall in when it comes to wanting to like walk that line of maybe wanting to have cool industry people paying attention to you and an industry driven career, that particular type of validation, and then actually like if that doesn't feel comfortable for you wanting to live a genuine life?
Oh, I'm trying to figure that out every day. I mean, that's, you know, I'm very lucky that I have really wonderful people helping me manage me and book shows for me. And when this record came out, these wonderful people who do press, they hired them for me. And thank God, because if it were left to me, I'm the worst. I barely remember to tell my friends when I'm playing in the town they live in. I'm just the worst. Because I'm busy, I'm a mom, I'm distracted, and I do find that part of the industry, it's just an unfortunate part of the music industry, and I guess any artistic industry, but I'm so much more into collaboration, and so I balance it with that. There's my answer. I really balance it with that, because we all have to play the game to some degree. We have to network and meet people and sometimes do gigs we don't want to do because it's the right gig to do. And there is that. It's unavoidable. But, you know, I think it's important for all of us to ground and get back to our people, our musical tribe. We all have that where we live. I'm part of such a network of folks here in Woodstock. It's like amazing. I can't even believe the people I get to call friends and neighbors. And so that's how I do it, coming back and grounding with my community, really. And that's what I'm trying to do at the barn. You know, I'm trying to continue the legacy there with that, so that the barn is a place of community and opportunity for all musicians, whether they're considered hip or not, you know, because that you don't want to get lost in that. That's a bunch of bullshit that nobody needs, you know.
When do you learn that lesson? What age?
I don't know. I'm
when
still.
Will it come?
I'm 50 and I'm still trying to learn it. I think we just cling together and find a better way through it every year, right? Okay. That's kind of how we do it.
Good deal. Speaking of the barn. Your dad and Garth Hudson designed and built the barn for musicians by musicians. I have never been to the barn, unfortunately, but like have known about it by reputation for, 20 years or so. I'm wondering like what lessons you have learned from the barn about your musicality, and there's probably so much, but what you have learned from the barn that you try to take with you either on the road or in performing in other places?
I think from the physical space alone, the barn is, it sounds beautiful. Like to stand on that stage before a show with no lights on, no PA system, no microphones, it's just a beautiful sounding room. And because it was built by such thoughtful and connected, kind of touched musicians, you know what I mean? People that were that were thinking about this in a spiritually energetic way. And so it has that feeling when you just stand there and open your mouth and sing or take your instrument and play it in the empty room. There's a frequency there and it connects you to the song pretty immediately. And so that's a nice feeling to try to take with you when you go onto other stages. And I think there's a few places that make you feel that way. You know, there's a couple rooms, there's a handful of rooms in the States that have that. And so I think the barn is one of those, and I do take that with me. And also just, just trying to stay open about music. I think that we can always learn something. I get the opportunity to see so many bands at the barn and hear so much music. And I just think you can always learn something, even if it's not your thing that you think you'd usually like or the genre that you're used to. And so, you know, it's staying open, staying aligned with what feels good to you in a physical space. I think those are the two things that I try to take with me.
You had originally wanted to record What the Flood Leaves Behind in the Mexican Desert, which I totally support. And next time when you do that, I want to stop by and visit.
You know what? You're the only person. I feel like, is that a potential gender difference? I don't know, because I say that. And every time I said that, it must have been mostly men. Kind of like, huh? But I feel like every woman, and especially every mom who's heard me say that, is like, oh, yeah, I get it. She wanted to, like, get out of Dodge, you know, Yeah, I wanted to go on vacation. I wanted to be in some incredible little building with a plunge pool out the back.
Totally need the plunge pool. If you're not on the beach, you need the plunge pool.
Yeah.
For sure. I love Mexico and support any trips. But you ran the numbers and you're like, I guess it makes more sense to record at the barn.
Yes.
However, so this album sounds like you are in this comfortable kind of like at home feeling. That's what you get when I listen to it. And, you know, we always want to mix it up and crawl outside our comfort zone. And you and I have already discussed doing that in this interview. But what can you say about embracing that comfort, embracing familiarity?
Well, I'm repeating myself, I'm sure, from other interviews, but it really is my true answer to that is that I was really humbled by the room, of course, after my Mexican desert fantasy and all of that stuff. When I walked into that room, you know, the room is just a special place. And I think also, I think that those songs and the time I was at in my life, which was not that long ago, we did that record a year and a half ago, you know, I think it needed to be there. It needed to be in my home with all of the ghosts and all of the difficult memories and beautiful memories and a room that I learned how to make music in. And I think mm-hmm. the record needed to happen there. So it was humbling. You know, when you make an album, there's this other thing that comes into play, this, you know, for however you want to call it, the Holy Spirit or some kind of energy or the muse, the creative kind of mist. Every record I've ever done or been a part of, you always see it kind of comes in and shapes it the way it wants it. So I think in this case, the room was part of that.
Josh Kaufman produced the record, and he's... it's funny, I met Josh like in 2008, I think. He was in Don Landis's touring band and also in Balthrop, Alabama, this band of just like incredible people. And Annie, his wife, was playing bass in that band.
She's incredible,
Yeah, it's amazing to see what he's been doing recently, producing all these amazing records, including yours. He's been working with Josh Ritter, Taylor Swift, The National, and The Hold Steady. He's truly... having a moment, and you and Josh had great chemistry and decided to work together and made the record at the barn, which you have described as being like a tuning fork for the album. I want to know about, like, how do you think Josh and the barn work together?
Well, I think that Josh and all the players that were part of the record, Phil Cook and Tony Mason and Dan Goodwin, who engineered the record, Michael Libramento, Dan Littleton, they all had the same response to the room that I was having, but it was their own relationship to it, you know. Obviously, they didn't have the childhood memories, but everybody was having their own interaction with it, and it was palpable. I mean, we talked about it. Every day we'd get in. It's like we knew we were in something special. We just all could feel it when we got in there. So I think Josh really loved making the record there. And I just actually did a very cool video with Josh and Annie. Annie came and played bass, and we did a version of Cotton in the Cane at the barn and met there just last week, actually. So, you know, we were once again just talking about the room itself and the specialness of it.
Mm. So you recorded this record right before the pandemic hit and released it the year after the pandemic hit. Verse 23 is a really important song on the record. It's where the title comes from. The line is, "What the flood leaves behind is what we've got to make." And it sounds like that line is really meaningful to you. And I want to know, like, what it means to you and how it might have changed for you since the start of the pandemic.
We were talking about that as a title before the pandemic hit. And that's what I had kind of landed on, just because I love that idea of resurrection, rebirth. You know, what the flood leaves behind is what we've got to make. Like, we build ourselves up from the things that are painful, leave us with the things we build from. I mean, it just is part of living, right? And then, of course, with the pandemic, it just became, it was accidental to give it that title. Mm-hmm. And it was accidental that the thing got released right after this, you know, this shutdown. But it's fitting. And I've had the chance to sing that song. I haven't done much touring this summer, but I've played a handful of shows and gotten to play these songs live maybe 10 or 15 times. And when I've done verse 23, I can feel the impact of that lyric on people. Hmm. You know, it's interesting.
So your two boys, Huey is 9 and Lee is 13, and Lee is turning into like...
Lee is turning into I don't even know what, a 40-year-old something, and Huey just turned 10.
And double digits. That's
double
a big
digits.
Deal.
Double digits. It's a big deal. Just turned 10 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, we went to Zoom Flume. We went to a water park. He's doing great. He had his first day of fourth grade today. Lee is 13. He loves music. He loves the Grateful Dead. He loves playing drums. He's got a band with his... He's got all these really awesome, talented friends that are all his age. They have a band. They haven't titled it yet, but you'll be hearing about it soon enough, I'm sure.
That's cool.
Very driven. They're great.
I heard about your secret scheme to get them both as your rhythm section.
Oh, yeah. That would be fantastic. I've got to get Huey on bass. He's a little resistant right now, but I'm working on it.
You're like, no, mommy needs a band.
Yeah.
It's going to work out. You're going to love it.
Yeah, put soccer to the side. Let's work on your bass playing.
Let's get the charts going. So especially since Lee is a drummer, what do your boys understand about their granddad's legacy, and how do you keep Levon in their life?
I think they understand it. Lee, of course, understands it a bit more, and they have a great perspective about it. Lee has a great perspective about it. And also Lee has like really incredible music teachers here. And Lee is homeschooled. So my younger son is in the regular school here, and Lee has been homeschooling for the past few years. So he does a music class with Mike and Ruthie. He has an incredible set of teachers at Rock Academy, which is run by Jason Bowman, who's a great drummer and great musician. And he's just got all of my friends, Tony Leone and Tony Mason, and all the drummers that I know that come up for Ramble Band stuff. And Zach and Connor, our whole tribe has kind of, you know, taken him under their wing. And he has all of these friends that play too. So he's just got a great perspective on respecting who his grandfather was, but not he's not self-conscious of it. Yeah, he's very balanced about it.
Before we go, will you do the lightning round?
The lightning round. Sure. What is that?
Yes. It's where I ask you fun questions to show that we all contain multitudes. And you'll enjoy it. Or you won't. You might not enjoy it. Okay. Here we go. What was the first song you learned on the guitar?
I can think of the chords, but I don't play a lot of guitar. Maybe I'll tell you the first song I learned on the mandolin, because I never played a lot of guitar. Axis Bold as Love, Jimi Hendrix.
The great mandolin song.
It's a classic for mandolin.
What is your karaoke song?
Oh, I've never done karaoke, but if I did it, I want to do karaoke. It would be maybe Dim All the Lights, Donna Summer.
I would suggest at the barn one night to do live band karaoke. That might be fun.
Oh, yes.
With all your pals. Ask Mike and Ruthie about that.
Yeah.
Dogs or cats or something else?
Dogs.
What is your coffee order?
Oh, at Starbucks? Either a triple espresso in a short cup with steamed half and half on the side. I like to add it myself. Or if I'm in a rush and I don't want to go through the hardcore because they're like, what? How do I ring that up? And blah, blah, blah. It's a short, flat white, extra hot.
Great. Complicated. Love it.
I'm
First celebrity crush.
First celebrity. Ricky Schroeder.
Oh.
John Cusack in high school.
Oh, good one. Who is the nicest musician you've ever met?
I've met a bunch. Melissa Etheridge comes to mind. I don't know her well. I got to shake her hand. I don't think she would remember me or know who I was, but I got to shake her hand once backstage when we were opening for Phil Lesh at some festival with my dad, and she watched our show, and she was so... I just wanted to hang out with her. She was just so cool and sweet. But I've met a lot. Bonnie Raitt's very nice. Elvis Costello is very nice. But Melissa Etheridge comes to mind first.
First album you bought with your own money?
Probably the Go-Go's.
What was your first concert?
Oh, my first concert that wasn't the band. The band, obviously, was my first concert because I was drug up to a bunch of those shows. But my first non-band concert was The Police. And there is one of my first crushes, Stuart Copeland. That's the drummer's name, right? No, Stuart Copeland's from the Eurythmics. What's the drummer's name? No, Stuart Copeland. Am I right?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Well,
that name sounds very familiar to me.
As long as Stuart Copeland is the drummer of The Police, I just want to go on record to say that I was 11 years old or 12 watching him in an amphitheater in Minnesota, and I was madly in love with him forever.
Wow.
From that moment on.
Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Rolling Stones, the Rolling Stones.
Oh, but you're not a bad kid. The Beatles are for the good kids, and the Rolling Stones are for the bad kids.
Oh, yeah.
I guess maybe you are a bad kid.
Bad in the way a dorky rule follower could be bad, yeah. I think.
Bad to the bone.
Bad to the bone.
Okay. Here is the last question. Where is the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
That is a really hard question. There's so many beautiful places that I've seen and in the world, but I think that my most beautiful place is when the light is perfect in the late afternoon coming through my kitchen window and it's quiet in the house and I've just made a cup of coffee and the trees and the mountains are just outside my window and my kitchen is just like flooded with this silent, perfect moment. That's the most beautiful place. That's my afternoon coffee before anyone needs anything. No gigs, no kids, no work, no nothing, just total quiet. I love that.
That's a really good answer. Love
that.
Thank
you. Thanks.
Amy, thank you so much for talking and taking so much time.
Thank you for the questions. What an incredible interview. Much has left me much to think about and write about. It's good questions to continue to dig into our stories and stuff. Thank you.
Basic Folk this week was produced by John Nungesser. Our music composed by Alex Stanton of Townspeople. Basic Folk is on the American Songwriter Podcast Network. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, and thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend. And you can hear all of our episodes wherever you get podcasts or at basicfolk.com. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.